beside the sea. It happened on a night.
Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Elizabeth Hyder, author of the mystery novel May the Wolf Die from Penguin Books. Elizabeth is a PhD physicist whose most recent jobs include work for Microsoft's AI4 Science Research Program and the European Space Agency's Human Spaceflight Program. Her short fiction has earned recognition from the Santa Fe Writers Project Literary Awards and the New Century Writer Awards. Her nonfiction includes numerous research papers, a chemistry patent, and war games written for the Navy and other U.S. government agencies, as well as a comic series developed by the European Space Agency. She lived and worked in Naples, Italy for several years, deploying as a civilian analyst aboard U.S. and European naval ships, and she's currently based in The Hague. May the Wolf Die is Elizabeth's first published novel, and if you're like me, you'll find it hard to believe she hasn't already written a dozen. The book was named a New York Times Best Crime Novel of 2024, a Washington Post Best Mystery of 2024, and a Publisher's Weekly Best Book of 2024. Before we get started, a reminder that KABU is in the middle of our annual All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign going on now through April 15th. You can check out our full list of specials and marathons at kabu.fm/ATNF4. Please join us now for our conversation with Elizabeth Hyder, which is already in progress. Elizabeth, first I have to say that I read May the Wolf Die over the holidays after seeing it listed as the Washington Post Best Mystery of 2024, and I loved it. As you know, I told you all about it. I got in touch with you and practically begged for this interview, so thank you for saying yes.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I was really excited to be here.
And May the Wolf Die is your first published novel, which amazes me considering how good it is. But you've had that writing bug for a long time, going back to when you were 8 years old.
Yeah, ever since I can remember. Yeah, I've been writing my whole life. So when I was 8 years old, my mother took my sister and I to a adult learning, you know, ongoing learning creative writing class in the evenings at a local high school, taught by Lofton Harvey, who was an English teacher at Bingham High School. And he was wonderful. And we went there for years. And so we would bring our little stories that we'd written over the week, and we would, you know, go around the group and read out loud and get feedback. And it was just such a wonderful, nurturing experience. And then Lofton ended up being an English teacher for me when I went to high school. And he was just a wonderful advocate and a wonderful friend. And we're still in touch. So it was a great experience. So yeah, I've been writing my whole life, and this is definitely not the first book I've written.
Now, you grew up in South Jordan, Utah, and you've said, quote, your family were all unrepentant bibliophiles. I wonder what you were reading at the time, maybe books that inspired you to write your own stories?
Oh my gosh. I mean, my parents just had books all over the house. I mean, they would get them used, cheap, whatever. I mean, they set up really rudimentary bookshelves everywhere. So I just read whatever I could get my hands on. So a lot of classics, actually. My mother really was a fan of the classics. And so some of my favorite books when I was like 12 years old were, you know, Jane Eyre and The Count of Monte Cristo and Sherlock Holmes and, you know, Jane Austen's books. So it was just a wonderful environment to just indulge as much as possible.
Now, you graduated high school at the age of 16 and enrolled in the University of Utah's actor training program. So a year of theater studies, and you performed and worked by great playwrights, Shakespeare, Chekhov, David Mamet. Why acting as the next step? Why not a program in creative writing?
I just got the acting bug when I was in high school. So I did Shakespeare there. I did a number of different plays and competitions, and I had a group of friends I really loved, and I loved to act. And so it was a great experience. And so I auditioned for this conservatoire program at the University of Utah and got in, and it was a kind of an elite group of kids, and I loved it. I mean, I kept writing. I don't think it occurred to me to like go take classes in creative writing. I think I just did it, and then I acted. So that was the first year of college.
So from creative writing to theater to what seems, at least to me, like a complete turn, an undergrad degree in physics followed by your master's and PhD in the same subject at Tufts University. I'm wondering why the switch from the arts to the science and I sciences, and I saw in a social media post you mentioned the Scully effect.
Oh, that's true. Yes. Yeah, I mean, that was about the time that I went to university was, the X-Files was out. I grew up in a very religious community that had very strict gender roles, and so it hadn't really occurred to me that I would do something like a hard science or physics, and I didn't really feel like I was particularly gifted in math. And so I think I just was interested in a incidental way in physics, and so I was reading, I think initially reading like A Wrinkle in Time by Madeleine L'Engle and getting introduced to some of the concepts of physics when I was young. I really enjoyed that. So her sort of take on particle physics and this really interesting introduction to that. And I read Stephen Hawking and some Isaac Asimov, and just really enjoyed some science fiction. And I don't think it was until I was like 16, 17 years old, that it kind of occurred to me that women could also do physics. And so
Thanks
I sort of was
thanks to
like,
Dana
yeah.
Scully.
Well, Scully, and also I think that actually the moment the penny dropped for me was actually when I watched the movie IQ with Meg Ryan, where she plays the niece of Albert Einstein, and
All
it's this
right,
romantic
yes.
comedy. And so I got myself a Meg Ryan haircut and went and took Physics 101, and used the office hours. I remember the professor was a real sweetheart, Michael Solomon, and I came and knocked on the door and asked him to explain how a graph worked. So I just was intrigued by the whole by the whole concept, and I wanted to study it. So I had to start at ground zero and just start with basic math, college algebra, just work my way through calculus, and just took basic physics courses, and then, as you mentioned, finished a PhD in physics at Tufts University.
And you graduated with that PhD in physics and then worked for the next 8 years as a civilian researcher with the U.S. Navy. What were you hired to research? Or was it physics related?
Yeah, so I was what's called an operations research analyst, and I worked with the US military and that, government agencies. So operations research was kind of started during the Second World War, which was basically taking people with PhD brains, physicists and engineers, and trying to solve problems, military problems. So I think the US Navy basically had taken some Harvard and MIT physicists and asked them to solve the German U-boat problem. And so that was where the start of the Center for Naval Analysis was, which was the federally funded research and development corporation that I was working for, I was hired to work for. And so now it just has a bunch of PhD brains, solving really complex, undefined, squishy problems in the military. And so that's what I was hired to do. So we would I worked a number of different projects. I wrote war games with a group of guys that were pretty awesome, and women as well. And sort of looking at, in this particular scenario, what is the response going to be? So we would have to invent crazy scenarios or try to, create play and then play the bad guys. And so sort of see and map out what the response would be in a particular case. And that was interesting. Also observing exercises and operations real time and writing up reports. And so I would deploy with the Navy at various times. I would deploy on my first deployment was on an aircraft carrier. And I did that for a couple of weeks, and that was pretty cool. And then I spent a few months off the west coast of Africa in a amphibious transport dock ship called the USS Nashville. So it was this it was taking a cruise down the west coast of Africa. So that was in January of 2009. So I spent a few months on that ship, and that was Africa Partnership Station. It was a training engagement off the west coast of Africa, trying to build up the maritime capability of local forces, and responding to drug smuggling, piracy, at sea robberies, arms trafficking, illegal fishing, etc. So
Wow.
I kind of got hooked doing that, and that's how I ended up working in Naples as well. So yeah, so I worked that for a while.
And we could see a little of that experience in the especially the aircraft carrier and working on a ship with other U.S. Navy personnel.
Oh yeah, for sure. No, I kind of it was such a fascinating experience as a civilian to be on board a US Navy vessel. It's not something I think that's a typical experience for people. And so I kind of had to kind of catch up and learn fast and end up being an environment I really enjoyed working in. It was some of the best experiences I've had.
And that also was your introduction to Naples. While working for the Navy during those years, you spent three of them, I think, living in Naples, and you clearly have a great love and knowledge of the city. Do you remember your first impressions?
Oh yeah. So the first impressions, I had gone to Naples. So U.S. Naval Forces Africa is based in Naples, Italy, and so this is the book is actually set in Naples, kind of at that intersection between local culture and the U.S. military presence there. So I actually went out to Naples, I think in 2008, for an exercise, and it was exciting and it was crazy. I mean, it's a really it's a nutty city. I mean, it's just chaotic and. You'd have to really sort of embrace and lean into the chaos, but it was unlike any experience I'd ever had previously. And I just fell in love. It was just love at first sight. It's one of the most beautiful places on earth, but also the just absolutely insane. So I really fell in love with it.
Now, I don't want to dwell too much on your resume, but it's fascinating. After your work with the Navy, you moved to the Netherlands, where you live now. You're working for the European Space Agency, and you supported the International Space Station, which was in the news recently. Can you talk a little bit about that? What did you do to support the space station and with the space agency?
Yeah, so I worked at I want to get the acronym wrong. It's
Aha.
called ESTEC. I mean, I know it's kind of European Science and Robotics. I can't. I'm going to get this totally wrong. It's Robotics and Technology, and it's over in Noordwijk in the Netherlands. So, it has a range of different, space-based activities that take place there, but one of them is supporting human space flights. And so we have the International Space Station, which is continuously manned, and there are science payloads that need to go up onto the station for the crew members to conduct on a regular basis. And so my group was part of the group in charge of coordinating those payloads and making sure that the science requirements were met, to make sure that they were, you have a particular set of requirements that a scientist is trying to conduct on board the space station. And so helping to guide that process, make sure that the right equipment is up on the right rocket at the right time and that the crew members are trained appropriately. And
That's a
so the
lot of
science windows are
responsibility. Wow.
respec. Well, I was part of a team. It wasn't just me. But yeah, so that was part of my responsibility, was sort of that, helping shepherd the payloads and to make sure that the science was conducted appropriately on board station. So but yeah, as I mentioned, I was part of a huge team. So I can't necessarily take credit for the whole thing, but I was a cog in the machine. So, and then coordinating internationally, because of course it's international. So we had our counterparts at the Canadian Space Agency and NASA and the Japanese Space Agency. So we would coordinate with them on a weekly basis to make sure everything was lined up and that we had our priorities correct. So that was my job for a very long time.
And I read that included writing comics for the space agency.
That was actually not, it was not part of the job. It turned out to be just a weird thing I did, which was I used to have to watch, I would sit in the console room and watch the crew members doing their stuff and floating around and doing experiments and, making sure everything was done properly and seeing when an anomaly occurred and trying to respond to that and try to support that. And, anyway, I would just kind of like be out of my mind after hours and hours of this. And so I got to the sort of like paradigm shift at one point where I started to see the experiments not from the perspective of the astronauts conducting them, but from the experiment's perspective itself, right? And so
Sounds like a fiction writer.
exactly. And so I just, I was there was one experiment where it was like it had been it hadn't been active since, Alexander Garish, the crew member, came up, the last time. And so it was, and so he was coming back. And I thought, oh man, this experiment must be so excited to see him again.
Hey, welcome
So,
back, Alex.
yeah, oh my gosh, I missed you. And so, So the European Space Agency, the one this wonderful public affairs team, we're on board with this crazy idea, and they hired this fabulous artist, Ed Grace, and he drafted this comic series. And so it was just this, it was fun. It was a great experience. And it was kind of, it was part of the Columbus. So the Columbus module is the European Space Agency's module on board the space station. And it was the 10-year anniversary of that. So it was kind of released at the same time. So it was just this nutty idea that we had.
And one more non-fictional point on the resume, and I only mention this because I also work for the same company, but you started working about 2 years ago for Microsoft, their AI for Science program, which is their AI research lab. I worked there for many years in Redmond, Washington, on a much more mundane project, Windows Server and Developer Technologies. But it seems that Microsoft would be a very far cry from the US military.
It kind of is, yes. It was really fun to sort of see the different types, you know. Actually, I mean, talk about fiction writer. So I really the first week that I was there, and you know, this group of scientists, like getting researchers getting together, and they would do their work, and then everybody would get together and have lunch together. And I was sitting at the table eating lunch with this big group of researchers, and I realized I had this feeling that somehow I'd gotten into like Hogwarts, and this was Ravenclaw, and I was like, this is the new house that I was in. So it was a totally different environment. Some really brilliant people there, really, really smart people there.
I felt the same way in Redmond. Yeah, you're just working with really intelligent people from all over the world. We had a lot of people from China, India, Russia working with us.
Yeah, it's
And
really global, isn't it?
yeah, and they all had other interests too. I mean, a lot of the developers were also musicians or, artists. You're like
Yeah,
Einstein,
just
played the
really,
violin.
really multifaceted, fascinating people, really, really cool people. I mean, I still like I've kind of kept tabs. There's one of the teams that I was working with is actually has a publication coming out in Nature in a few months, and it's like it's pretty exciting some of the work that they did, and so they very kindly put my name on their paper because I was doing the project management for them. But it's been fun to watch everybody just, I mean, just the real brilliance of this group of people. So I've been enjoying that a lot.
Now let's focus on Elizabeth as the fiction writer. So the book, the very first scene has the protagonist Nikki Serafino on her sailboat Calypso. She's sailing on the in the Gulf of Naples, and she's with her friend Valerio. He's the boat's co-owner, and he works undercover in the Naples Police Anti-Corruption Unit. Oddly enough, the very idea of the book got its start in a similar situation for you in 2021.
It did indeed. You totally did your homework. So
Thanks.
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so the book is actually the characters of Valerio and Nikki are inspired by two people in the real world. The character of Nikki, I've got to make sure I don't actually let the name slip, is a friend of mine that I met when I was stationed in Naples back in 2010. And she's just incredible. Like she's just a really strong, fierce, capable operator. She's an investigator with an organization that's analogous to Phoenix 7 in the book. And you know, we've stayed in touch over the years, and I was heading down to Naples in 2021, and she said, "Oh, I'll take you sailing." And I said, "Great, love to go sailing. It's a wonderful idea." And she co-owns a boat with this undercover police officer. Also can't say his name, but anyway, so over there we are in the Gulf of Naples, and I looked at the two of them, and they're great friends, you know, and I just looked at them and I was like, how are you not characters in a murder mystery?
And you felt you had to write that mystery then, huh?
Oh, I had to. I sort of like you know, floated the idea just kind of as a joke to see how it would land, and they were like, ha ha ha, you know. And then afterwards I said, no, seriously, like how would you feel
Wow.
if I yeah, based, you know, like inspired, these characters are inspired by these real life amazing strong people. And they very kindly actually consulted for the book and made sure that it was as accurate as possible. So I'm very grateful for their support.
When you came up with the idea, Elizabeth, were you already a fan of murder mysteries? Or did you then have to do a lot of reading to learn more about the
Oh,
genre, the formulas?
no. I absolutely love murder mysteries. Yeah, I've been reading them for years. I think when I was young, I read every Agatha Christie there was. So,
And I know you
yeah.
mentioned John Le Carré in an
Oh,
interview.
absolutely one of my favorites. Yeah. So he's top of the list. John le Carré and Stieg Larsson and Robert Galbraith. Yeah, I love murder mysteries for sure.
And I saw a recent blog post. You listed a number of resources. One seemed very primary. It was How to Write a Mystery, a handbook from Mystery Writers of America, edited by a great mystery writer, Lee Child. So
Yeah, yeah,
you still
yeah.
did a lot of research in addition to your background, loving and
Oh,
reading a
for
lot of
sure.
mysteries.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I've written, I think, I recently said incorrectly that I'd written seven. This was the seventh book I'd written. Actually, I'd written se eight books. So this is the eighth book I've written. This is the first book I've gotten published. But it is the first mystery I've written. And so I tend to be like, so writers fall into two categories. Like they're either plotters or pantsers, right? You've
Oh
heard this,
yes,
right?
I've talked to pantsers. Some of them are really obsessed about it. They'll write sentence by sentence without knowing what's coming next.
Oh yeah, no, I'm a total pantser. Like by nature, I'm a pantser. So every book up until this one was pantsing. And so which is just like for your listeners, like it's you're writing by the seat of your pants, basically. It's also known as like architects and gardeners, right? So pantsers are sort of gardeners. But because I was going to be using these real world professionals consulting for this book, I wanted to make sure that I wanted to feel confident that I could get to the end and actually have crafted a good book. And so I knew that I had to plot for this one. And so it took me a minute. So I think it was September 2021 where I was when I went sailing, and then I floated this idea past my friend, and it wasn't until January where I was actually able to sort of feel that I had enough of a grasp of what the plot should be. And so I was out for a long walk. I live close to the sea here in Scheveningen in the Netherlands, and I like to go for long walks and even late at night, which is not probably a very safe idea, but I do it anyway. But it was January 17th of 2022, and I went for a long walk, and I just sort of was thinking like, okay, so, I didn't want to write a murder mystery where I didn't understand the murderer, right? Like somebody who was just psychotic or like a serial killer or something, because I didn't feel like I could understand that. So I asked myself the question, what would it take for me to be willing to kill somebody? Like, not that I would, but like, what would it take for me to get to that point where I might be willing to do it? And so then, I continued walking and thinking, and I started taking some voice notes. And by the end of the walk, I go for very long walks, like 2, 3 hours. And by the end of that walk, I had the whole plot. And so then I kind of had
Oh,
to sit down and,
I just have to ask you, what did you come up with? What would it take for you to do something like that?
Oh, you got to read the book.
Oh, okay.
That's the answer, right?
Oh, that's the answer. Oh,
That's
okay.
the answer,
Because I
right?
could think of several things. The murderer here is own personal experience, without giving anything away, I hope. But
Yeah.
in my personal experience, I could think of different things. So I didn't know. But this was the answer you came up with. Wow, that's
Yeah,
great.
that is. Yeah, it is. Yeah, so that was sort of the origin of this plot, right? And so at that point, you're right, I did reference there's a wonderful book, How Done It as well. Actually, I've got it right here.
Not just how to write a
Ended up
mystery, but
getting
how done
yeah,
it.
How Done It. And this is just a bunch of this is a master class in the members of the Detectives Club, and they basically have there's just essay after essay about like different aspects of writing a murder mystery. So I sort of drew on that structurally to make sure that that was going to work. And so this was the first book that I actually had plotted out before I wrote it. Yeah.
Oh, I think anybody reads it can just see all the plotting. And I read it twice, and I saw a whole lot, knowing who done it, that I didn't see in the first reading. Subtle foreshadowing. We talked a little bit about that before we sat down and turned on the mic. But yeah, it's very complex. Also, the research. You did a ton of research, not just about how to write a murder mystery, but about Naples itself, the local police, the presence of the Navy in Naples. I mean, even beyond your personal experience, how'd you go about it? Reading, exploring, you mentioned talking with friends, maybe even a few cold calls.
Yeah, so actually, fortunately, because so for the Navy perspective, that research was my own. It was originated in my own experience because I've been sort of embedded with the Navy for a number of years, including deployments, and I also had a number of friends from the Navy as well who were willing to read the book and make sure that I didn't get too too far off, you know. I remember one instance where I couldn't remember what it was that's it was said when the admiral comes in the room. I remember something was said and I couldn't remember what it was, and it's attention on deck. And so I just like even little details like that that I had remembered had happened during meetings, et cetera, but I couldn't remember the details. And so of course I referenced my friends. But yes, this investigator friend that inspired the character of Nikki very kindly like facilitated a bunch of research for me into local culture. You know, she actually showed me around to places, took me places that I couldn't go safely by myself. Introduced me to people. I mean, took me to neighborhoods where, I mean, I would definitely be unsafe as an American, you know, as a foreigner walking around. But because she was local and also because she was security trained, that she was it was able to facilitate those places and those introductions. Also, her friend who co-owns the boat with her is in the Naples police force, and so he took a took us on a tour of the police station, which was incredibly important for this book, to be able to understand like how does that function, answer my questions, met the members of his team, how does this team work, you know, I mean, they, you know, handling their equipment, you know, being in their office, understanding how those things worked. Went across the street to the Polizia Scientifica, which is the forensics division of the police, and talked to was able to interview, watch somebody get processed, you know, biometric screening, etc. I also have policing friends that I've met through my work when I was doing work with the so I had a company as well that I did some consulting with, and I did some work for Interpol in that role, and so I had some friends that were in the policing division there, and so they very kindly have agreed to interview, so that was very helpful. And then yes, I mean just being embedded in local Naples culture, just living there for years and years was a really good starting place, and I made a number of friends that were able to also advise me there. So and I was very 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 fortunate in my background to be able to write this book. I think it would have been incredibly challenging to do so if I hadn't had those experiences.
Yeah, Naples alone. I was just there for a few days. I love the city, but really the reader is immersed in the city. You take us places like you went with your friend that we couldn't go on our own safely.
Yeah. And always also just places I like to hang out. You know, like
Ha.
I talk about the literary quarter of Naples by Piazza Dante. And I love to go there. I was just there 2 weeks ago and just wandering around. You know, it's a wonderful place. So the historical center of Naples is gorgeous. I mean, it's not all murder there.
No.
It's really lovely. And you enjoyed it as well, I understand.
Oh, I just loved it. We were there twice, within about 10 days of the visit. The first time just for 2 days, and the second time we stayed over for an extra 3, 4 days, and just walking around on our own. And I felt very safe, but I think I was more in the tourist sections, so the Via Toledo, like that area. And then, of course, seeing a lot of Maradona. The patron
Yes.
saint of Naples.
Absolutely. Yes, he
Yeah.
is. Yes, Santo Gennaro and Santo
Now,
Maradona. Yes.
writing a novel, well, you wrote six books before that, but you did a lot of science writing. I was kind of wondering, did the physics background and research papers help? Does that help at all with your fiction?
Yes and no. I think the way in which it helps is there's two ways in which it really helps. One is it really helped refine my language so that I could be very precise in identifying what it was I wanted to say and then saying it with as just as parsimoniously as possible. Like, how do you say it in the most elegant, precise way? And so I think that years and years of doing that with my physics and science writing really sort of helped refine that particular capability. And I'm very grateful for that. And the second way in which it helped is in editing, right? So, you know, you can't expect to like write something and have it be perfect when you write it. You know, it's like you're gonna have a good approximation, but you're gonna have to refine it and refine it and refine it and rework it and reshape it and retool it until it is what you want it to be. And so I think that's something that I learned from a lot of my analytical science writing. The
Because
thing that
science papers are reviewed by other people before they're
Absolutely.
published.
Absolutely. And you want to make sure that you're saying, you know, your logical flow is exactly right and that you're tracking on exactly what you want to be tracking on and you're saying exactly what you want to say. And so that precision in language, I think, is extremely important, and that really helped me. Oh, I guess a third way in which it helped me is that a murder mystery is very technical, right? So you have to make sure that you track every single thread in a very analytical fashion. You can't drop anything. And so I actually have like spreadsheets. This is embarrassing. I have spreadsheets tracking like plot threads and clues, and how does the story evolve, and making sure that everything ties up appropriately. I mean, there's literally a spreadsheet for May the Wolf Die, and also a spreadsheet for the subsequent novel that I just finished, because I don't know how somebody tracks it if you're if you're not doing that. That's my way of tracking. So those are the three ways in which being a physicist really helped. But I think the real distinction that I also have learned is that data and science writing is very impersonal. And so it's very factual. You're going to name the facts, the things that happen, but that's not necessarily telling the truth. The truth is something different, So truth also involves like the human element of your emotional landscape and your beliefs and the depth and the meaning of a particular situation and the layers of your own personal history and your interpersonal relationships and your sort of a spiritual reality as well. And I think, if you just parse it out into some sort of fact after fact after fact, it sort of strips it of that humanity. And so I find that I have to sort of divorce myself from my analytical writing side when I write fiction, which actually is a wonderful thing. I really love, I love fiction for that reason.
So there's a lot you're getting from writing fiction you don't get from the science writing. And I've talked to other writers too. I mean, writers have written about it, how you can get to the truth through fiction. And also there's empathy, which really doesn't play a part in scientific papers. And that's getting to
Yes.
know even the bad characters in a book, getting to know them a little bit. As you mentioned, what would it take for somebody to do these horrible crimes? And
Absolutely.
That's something you wouldn't put in a scientific paper. You don't really care about
No.
that.
And I think they just serve different purposes, right? Like science papers serve different purposes than fiction writing. I think one of the things I learned, doing analysis for the Navy is that, you can I used to think that you could influence how decisions were made by providing the right data. Like if I collect this data and I do this analysis and I show you unambiguously that you should make the following decisions, right? And you present that to the admiral or whatever, I used to think that I could influence outcomes by having a data-driven analysis, right? And that turns out to absolutely not be true. That is not a correct hypothesis. You can present all the data in the world, and somebody is absolutely not going to go with that decision. And that was such a revelation to me. And I did this analysis for years for, the military and for government organizations and other institutions. And I was always surprised by that. And what I've learned is that actually, if you want to influence somebody, you do it through story. That's the human operating system is story. And that's true for me as well. And so it's a way of me getting at my own personal truth, but also a way of communicating that isn't possible for somebody to understand just through the facts and figures.
Now, we should mention the title itself, May the Wolf Die. I had some idea of the meaning, especially when several bad guys in the book are described as wolves, but it actually comes from an old saying in Naples.
Yeah, this is great. I love Italian idioms are fabulous, but especially Naples idioms I love. If I were to wish you good luck, I would say in bocca al lupo, which literally means in the mouth of the wolf. So it's kind of like saying break a leg before a promise, right? And so in the mouth of the wolf is what I would say to you. And your response to me would be crepi al lupo, which means may the wolf die. So that's part of this exchange for the good luck saying. So it has a much more sinister meaning in this particular context of the book. But yeah, this is where it comes from.
Yeah, one character says it at one point. He's trying to stay away from the Camorra, the Italian mafia in the city. And he says, the world is run by wolves, it's their system. their rules. So,
Yes.
and not necessarily good people who are
I
running
guess.
the running things, as we can tell in the US right now. Now, Naples is a very vibrant and beautiful city, the third largest in Italy. As I learned and researched even afterwards, it's got a long history going back to the ancient Greeks. And it sits on the Gulf of Naples, where Nikki has her sailboat, in the shadow of Mount Vesuvius, famous for destroying Pompeii many years ago. What do you love about the city when you visit now? And what are some of the must-dos?
Oh gosh, I love that city. I love this city and I love the environment. I mean, you have to spend, I mean, if you're only going to spend a day there, I mean, you definitely just have to see downtown Naples. It's amazing. The historical city center is fabulous. They have just some gorgeous churches and some monuments, and the archaeological museum has like all of the, the Farnese collection. I mean, some of the most incredible pieces that you'll ever see are in the Archaeological Museum of Naples. It's just phenomenal. And then Cappella San Severo is the veiled Christ, is this incredible statue that is just stunning. So the historical city center is just amazing. And then the local environment is also incredible. So you take a ferry out to the islands of Capri or Ischia Procida, absolutely beautiful, beautiful. Or take a drive up the Amalfi coast to Positano and Amalfi or Ravello. Oh my gosh, the whole area is just gorgeous. What would you not do? Because I go there as often as I can. I used to live in Pozzuoli, which is
Oh,
is
that's
a
mentioned in
sort
the
of a
book.
yeah, it is the port of Pozzuoli. And so I used to live next to the Flavian Amphitheater there, which is like it was built the it was a sister amphitheater to the Colosseum, so it was about the same time period. And Pompeii, of course, you have to go to the ruins of Pompeii and Herculaneum. I mean, this is just it's to me, Naples and its area is some of the most beautiful place on earth. I just every time I go there, it just takes my breath away. I just love it. And
Yeah,
then,
I
of
love the
course,
people
it's
too.
Oh, I totally love the people. Yes.
I grew up in New York, so there's a lot of Italians in Italian neighborhoods, and you're very outgoing, extroverted. And I found that in Naples, as opposed to say, France, which I love, but the people a little more interior there.
Well, there's a tremendous amount of warmth that I had not expected. I'm kind of an introvert myself, but I just remember when I was living there, I'd go for a run around, I'd do go for my morning run, and there was a restaurant just down the street from where I lived, and the maitre would stand out front, and I never spoke very good Italian, but I'd stop and chat with him for a few minutes, and he'd tell me about his kids, and it was just such a warm, loving interaction, right? It was just somebody that I casually knew, and that happened many times. I mean, and people went out of their way to be kind and to help be helpful. I mean, it's also a very crime-driven city as well, and you can get taken advantage of pretty easily. But it's a really incredible culture. I really love the Neapolitan culture. It's wonderful.
Yeah, we mentioned the Camorra. That's the Italian mafia. I think they're based there and have been for many years. But I felt
Yeah.
fairly safe from what I heard. Theft is a problem, but people are not going to walk up and kill you or knife you. Generally, like in a U.S. city, certain sections of U.S. cities.
Well, there is, yeah, I mean, there's definitely organized crime. I mean, the Camorra has been around since like 1600s, 15, 1600s, 1700s, I think, too. I mean, there's like it's in various forms, right? It's kind of like a shadow government that's going on. And so that kind of crime would be, yeah, it's just a, isn't, it's going to influence the people who are caught up in it usually. I mean, unless you're incidentally affected. You're right. There's going to be some theft. There's quite a lot of theft there. But generally speaking, if you're a tourist, it's not that dangerous.
No, what amazed me, it seems very difficult to cross the street at times. Cars are coming, but I was told, and it actually works, you take a step in, you put your hand up, and the cars will stop. And amazingly enough, it worked every single time. Well, that's why I'm still here, I guess.
Is that in the grace of God?
I guess
Yeah,
so.
Naples traffic is crazy. Yeah, absolutely. So Naples driving is some of the craziest I've ever seen. Yeah, you just there's a lot of praying. You certainly can't multitask while you drive, that's for sure.
Now, you mentioned earlier Phoenix 7, which is the unit Nikki works for. It's fictional, but it's based on a real organization.
It
And
is.
she faces sexism from her boss and colleagues. There's one section of the book where you write, "Men were most comfortable when they didn't think of you at all. When they measured their value according to some standard that involved only other men, but when you distinguished yourself, they were forced to include you in their estimation of themselves. This only ever had one outcome, and it was always bad." So sadly, that part doesn't seem fictional. You didn't have to make up the sexism.
No, I did not.
Was that something that's you find in Italian culture? Well, certainly in the military, when you work with them.
I think any woman who's has had a professional life has encountered this in some form. I don't think this is something that's unique to Naples or the U.S. military. I think actually that particular section that you read to me is something that a lot of women have come forward to me to talk about in a range of fields in such a way that I realize it's kind of a universal experience. As much as we would hope that sexism has been, mitigated or eliminated, I think it's far from that. And I think that sort of the normalization of sexism that's happening right now indicates to us that actually it never did go away. It just went underground.
Yeah, we're also finding that with another theme in the book, and that's how difficult it is to be gay in Italy or anywhere else for that matter. So we take Nikki, the protagonist. Her late brother Adriano was gay, but he didn't feel he could come out to his parents and family. And you contrast that with an American Navy investigator working with Nikki, Special Agent Durant Cole, who talks openly about his ex-husband. And I'm just wondering, from the stereotype that I have of the Italian male, it seems like a culture steeped in masculinity, some might say toxic masculinity. And I imagine very difficult for anyone who doesn't fit the straight heterosexual male profile.
Yeah, I think that that's probably true in a majority of places of the world. I mean, not in terms of toxic masculinity per se, but in terms of like, it's a relatively recent phenomenon to normalize homosexuality. I don't think that's, I mean, even when I was in college, I remember even in Utah, so growing up in a very religious community, that was something that was considered sinful. And I think that's maybe the origin of difficulty with the, I mean, I've talked to my contacts in Naples, so I hesitate to speak to Naples culture personally from my personal experience. But the, but that it's sort of religious based, obviously, you know, tends to be of it being sinful, you know. And I think that that tends to be true in a lot of strong religious communities. And I do think there is, you know, obviously, anytime you have machismo culture, I think you're going to have some particular issues, arising from that. It's really nice. To have found in other environments where, you know, being gay is normalized and people can be comfortable in their sexuality. And but that's, to me, that feels like a more recent phenomenon in the last 20 or so years. It certainly wasn't true when I was growing up or when I was in college even.
Yeah, I'm kind of in a bubble here, I guess, in Portland, Oregon, where it's very normalized. So yeah, it's
that's
not quite
wonderful.
Like that outside the city. Or other big cities like San Francisco.
Or, rural communities still have issues sometimes. So, yeah. And I think it just depends on, what is the cultural background, how insular are things, you know, and what is acceptable and what's not. But certainly, I mean, in the U.S. military, I mean, the effort for Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which was put in place by Bill Clinton, was an effort to not overtly punish people for being gay. I mean, it was this, you know, it was a way of trying to protect them in a sense. Like if you don't disclose, then, you know, we're not necessarily going to seek it out whether or not you're gay and have to kick you out of the military, because it still was something you could lose your job over. You could, you know,
right.
And people have quite recently lost their jobs. You know, this is not, you know, news, you know, because I think Don't Ask, Don't Tell was only recently repealed. And who knows? I mean, I guess I'm concerned about the current state of affairs, you know, with what's going to happen. But
yeah, definitely.
But I think it did sort of encourage a lot of people to be. I mean, I personally know, like off the top of my head, two naval officers who were closeted gay and didn't disclose to me. I mean, I didn't find out until years after having worked with them. So it's still something it's kind of hidden.
Now, another thing I really enjoyed about the book, and this is something that I guess was a pet peeve of yours, you mentioned that you didn't like characters in books who were only described in terms of their work. And that's certainly not true of Nikki in this book. You give her a very rich personal life. We get to meet her family, her childhood friends, romantic partners and ex-partners. So you did a lot of work giving her a life beyond solving crimes, including telling us about some difficult financial issues she's going through.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I think this is all of us are more than just our work, right? We have multiple dimensions. And so I kind of feel like it's when I think about my particular work day, it's like, I'm worried about things, my personal life, I'm worried about my friendships, I'm certainly worried about my finances, I'm worried about where to get lunch, and so, like I think to me it makes more sense to include those elements in a, when you're describing somebody's life, I want to make sure that those are part of my characters.
Now, we also mentioned that there's a second book, which I think you're just about done with, and you have a planned 7-part series for Nikki. Are all 7 plotted out roughly? And I was wondering if each book will stand alone like this one, with a few mysteries that are solved, though advancing what I think is becoming an overarching story through the 7-part series.
You absolutely have that correct. So,
You can't say much more, I think, huh?
yes, I can't say a whole lot more. I will say that you will start noticing. Yes, it is all the major muscle movements of the 7-book series are plotted out. So sometimes I don't know exactly how things will play out, but the major pieces, I know where the characters will end up and why. And there is an overarching mystery to be solved. And so you'll see some of the clues to that mystery in the first book for sure. The second book is completely written and in fact, it's mostly edited. I actually am going to send my rewrites to my editor at the end of next week. And so hopefully, fingers crossed, she says yes and takes them.
I've
But yeah,
been reading some of the updates on your posts, social media posts, where you're in a coffee shop, going through all these edits.
am. Well, it's I it came into it ran in too long. I mean, that's the tricky bit, right? Is it's like a like this one came in at 133,000 words, and I needed to cut 20,000 words from the manuscript, which is a huge amount of words, and so it's a lot. But it's good to do that because it sort of it forces you to try to figure out what is essential. What I have to keep to this, to keep this book going. So yeah, so that book is very nearly finished, and it'll be published in February of 2026.
Oh, okay. That was one of my questions. I can't wait.
I don't have the publication date yet, but we've discussed it, and it looks like it's February of 2026 is
Because I
when the
read
next
this
book will
in
come
one of your
out.
blog posts, and I got to recommend Elizabeth's blog to every reader. There's a lot of background in there, and it's on her website. But this was at a recent post. You wrote, "If writing is a curious and exultant wander into a fantastic dream world, then editing is an obsessive compulsive descent into an accountant's dystopian hellscape," which sounds like a horror novel.
This has been my life, yes. So actually, I got the edits from my editor on January 6th, and it's literally been just it's been it's been bad.
But you mentioned one of your approaches too, which I absolutely love, because I've read about writers reading their own work. And in fact, I read that James Joyce did that with Ulysses, because there's a rhythm to it that you can't get if you're just not reading it. I do that even with my intros and all that, and even some of these questions. I'll read it out loud to see if it flows. There's just a rhythm. And you had mentioned, you talked about having to cut so many words. Quote, "Ruthlessly killing your darlings can be painful, but it's also necessary, and I have some good tricks for it. First, I think about the brilliant performer Simon Vance, who narrated May the Wolf Die," and I agree, I listened to the audiobook too. "I imagine him reading my prose aloud, and he's got this wonderful British accent. And if the thought makes me cringe at all, then I know I need to do more work." And Elizabeth, apparently you also use an app called Speechify, which so you don't have to read it out loud yourself. The app will read it out to you.
Yes. Actually, this was a wonderful, wonderful discovery this last year. When I wrote May the Wolf Die, I did record every chapter myself. So I would read it out to myself, and then I would listen to it while I went for walks, etc. And it's extremely helpful, like you mentioned, to be able to hear the words. But of course, like every time I would do another rewrite, I would have to do another reading, and it was really, really time intensive and just painful. And so, so Speechify is an AI app which does the reading for you. It's just heaven. I'm so happy about it. So every time I edit a chapter, I record, I get Speechify version of it, some person reading it out loud. And so then I can listen to it, while I'm doing the dishes or whatever, and sort of hear where there are problems.
Can you select a voice in Speechify that somewhat simulates Simon Vance?
Oh gosh, and he's phenomenal.
Oh, he is.
He is such an incredible. I am such a fangirl of his. He's amazing. But he takes, I mean, his reading of the book just adds so much depth to it. But so there's nobody that's going to read like Simon Vance, but it certainly does give me at least enough of a perspective where I can, you can hear just stupid mistakes that you make, like repeated words or like really bad phrasing or even just misspellings and stuff. And so it does sort of help me realize where I've made problems, so for myself. And so that's definitely a good trick for me.
I only have two more questions. The first is specific to the book, the second's more general. But there's rumors that the book and maybe Nikki's future adventures have been optioned for a television series. I saw in an interview you first talked about it, and you're under an NDA, so I don't know how much you can reveal at this time. But I think it's going to make a heck of a great show. The book alone, what a first season.
I can't wait to see it, actually. Yes. Yeah, I can't talk about details, but I can say it has been optioned. It's I'm excited. I'm excited. I really want to see it. I have this fantasy of being on, the boat with my friend and her friend that co-own the boat, and the actors playing Nikki and Valerio, and just like in the Bay of Naples with that. Like, this is my fantasy, is to go down there and watch it get filmed and to see it. I just can't wait to see
That would make a good TV
it.
show too.
Very meta.
Right. It's funny you mentioned meta, because the last thing I'd like to cover came up very recently, so just a week or so ago, and it's an issue that affects not just you, but thousands, hundreds of thousands probably of other writers. Meta, the corporation behind Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, Threads, has pirated, and I think that's the correct term, millions of books without the author's permission to train their AI platform. And you posted on Threads, ironically enough, recently, a quote, "I spent hundreds and hundreds of hours on the rewrites and edits alone, not to mention the heavy lifting of the research, plot, characters, and narrative arc." And Meta just stole it like that because they couldn't be bothered to go through a legal process. And you're not alone. So I'm wondering, what steps are you and other writers taking to stop the piracy and perhaps get compensated for the theft?
I haven't taken any steps yet. I understand there are some class action lawsuits against this. I think it's so deeply disturbing and so deeply unethical. I mean, it's I have one book out there that got pirated, and other people have had, dozens pirated. But everybody's put in such a tremendous amount of work for their books, and to just have it taken is so wrong. It's really deeply wrong. And I mean, I understand the incentive. I understand the motive. I mean, AI is like, it's an arms race right now, and there's this, to the victor go the spoils. And having worked in with Microsoft AI for Science, I know that it's like, having the right data and the right amount of data to train your model is really important. And there really is just no regulation for this, right? Like, this is such a new field, and I don't think that most people understand how AI works, and I don't think legislators understand how it works enough to just legislate it. But I think data sovereignty is a really important issue, and I think that unless we get a handle on that, and I just, to be honest with you, I feel so hopeless about whether or not we will wrestle with this as a society. I don't know if we're prepared for it yet. I deeply worry about what's going to happen with AI in the future, to be honest with
Well,
you.
hopefully a successful class action lawsuit will discourage corporations from doing this again if there's a multi-billion dollar payout. I heard something like for every stolen piece of work, it's like $50,000 to $100,000 compensation.
Do you think it would really happen though? I mean, I would love for
Yes, I
them to
don't
be
know.
successful with this, but like I'm not. I mean, I don't know. Like maybe I'm just deeply cynical. Maybe you can reference what I said in the book, you know, the world is run by wolves. But yeah, I don't I absolutely do not give permission to any organization to steal my words for training AI. Yeah, and I don't think any of us do.
No, definitely
Yeah.
not. And
Yeah.
in future interviews, I'll also be asking authors about this because this is an extremely important question to answer and issue to resolve, hopefully in a good way for the people who are creating the work and not AI, which is actually stealing it and simulating it.
It is, yeah. No, it's upsetting.
Well, Elizabeth, I didn't mean to end on a sour note there, but I love the book. It's been a great thrill to talk with you today. Grazie mille.
Prego. My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KABU Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, or would just like to hear it all again, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, Jonesy, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, zooming in all the way from her home in the Netherlands, Elizabeth Heider, author of the mystery novel May the Wolf Die from Penguin Books. You can learn more about Elizabeth, the book, her other publications, and find her very entertaining and informative blog online at elizabethheider.com. Just a reminder that KABU is in the middle of our annual All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign going on now through April 15th. You can check out our full list of specials and marathons at kabu.fm/ATNF4. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, April 10th. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying,
beside the sea.